Schmoes.
Schmoes, komm mal Schmoes, ja.
Okay.
Few minutes and then we'll discuss it.
Okay, just to bring a quacky up here.
Okay, we said it.
Hi. The Silver Spring and anybody watching the voice have special, even if it's special precedent. Okay, so
it's not.
And Ben, getting back out here. Ben? Okay, anyway. And Liel, on the door, you know Liel, have you ones? I don't know.
I'm learning from Washington. I never met you though.
Oh, okay, were you just coming out though?
Yeah, I learn a lot now. Yeah.
You're from Baltimore.
I don't know Baltimore.
You learned at the school there.
You both the academy people.
What's something to do with Silver Spring? Something to do with Silver
Spring? You might recognize it. Wow, so you really have a...
This is also the Academy. Tim, you don't want
him. He actually looks like a mental a little bit.
Not possible. Ethan, can you please put your keyboard on the spot? It's actually covering you.
Oh wow, so we really have a large presence.
Okay. That is the introduction. Baruch Hashem, it's a pleasure to have Rav Shiva Varno Lubyansky Shlita be with us for a small shiur and to open the floor to questions, issues of the times. I've been with us today, the representative of the yeshiva, Rav Shmuel Kiffel, and already a good friend, has told me that the questions in other yeshivas have been out there for all the challenges out there, I understand. And so we want to encourage as challenging questions as we can. And Rav Shmuel will be available after the shiur. Rav Lansky will be available as well. She will be available for any question a little bit.
I have a chasna. My oldest grandson is getting married today, so
okay, I've
got strict instructions to get moving at the right time.
I now all of a sudden have memories of our neighbor, being neighbors in our Zavira together, right across the street. Before, I was at your house this the Shabbos that Rabbi. Who's the Rabbi that
Merkin? Are you there?
He, that Shabbos? He was on Shabbos when he the deal was being made. Anyway,
wow.
Fine, I don't want to take any time. Kiff will be available, and other representatives of the yeshiva will be available through the lunch time to hear more about the yeshiva and the college program that goes on in the yeshiva. Okay, pleasure to have.
Okay, so Chumash Mos, if you can get, or if you have somebody has a Shmos here. Chumash Mos. So this is the whole program, or Shana Bet, or what is
Shana Bet?
What?
Some
Shana Aleph.
How is your trip, man?
Baruch Hashem, very, very nice. I mean, listen, it's wonderful to come for Simcha. What's your name?
Yehuda.
From?
Milwaukee.
Oh, sure. There was somebody, we have a boy in the high school, Margolis.
Oh.
Yeah, just came and he's thinking of coming to Yeshiva Dovi. Okay, so I wanted to start just with a vart. I guess the main, the vart itself, I'm basically saying over Joshua Saran, but... It's a very important. I'm going to try to say it over and explain it as best as I can. He's going on the pasuk. He's okay. He is explaining on the pasuk when it says Moshe Rabbeinu debated back and forth with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he said, you know, I'm a Kvad Peh and Arals Fasayim, and how am I going to speak to them? So we're back and forth with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him, finally, Vayeim Hashem Elov, Misom Peh LaAdam, who put a mouth, who gave a person a mouth? Oy mi yosum ilaim, o cheresh, o pikeach, o ive, or who makes a person mute, deaf, being able to see, or blind? Alo Anochi Hashem mi HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the pasuk. So many people ask, and the Ran gives his teretz, you know, if I walk into a room and I say, who lit the light in the room? That's a good question. It's a valid question. There are no lights in the room. And someone will come in and say, who put the darkness into the room? we'd look at the guy and say, are you trying to be funny, or you smoked something and inhaled? Like, what does it mean? Who put the darkness into the room? It's a room is dark unless somebody lit it up. So we understand the question of who made a person, who put a mouth in a person. That's a very good question. But this expression of who made a person mute or deaf or blind, those three things really, really don't sound right. Maybe it's poetic language. We actually come across this in davening every morning. We say Yotze Or Uvorei Choshech. HaKadosh Baruch Hu forms light and creates darkness. What does it mean he creates darkness? Darkness is the default setting. It's what you get when there is nothing. So why in the world would we say that? What do we mean when we use that term? And actually, bara is a very, very powerful word. It means to create from nothing almost. So it's the same point, same question. So the Ran offers the following understanding. Let's give a mashal for it, then I think we'll be able to understand it. Say there's a stranger. To most of you, I'm not a stranger, but we'll take Max just as an example. And someone say, why don't you take care of Max? Why don't you support him? Why don't you give him food? Why don't you this, that, the other thing? I would say, one second, if I give him, it's nice of me and it's kind of me. You may suggest that I give him, but it's a meaningless question to say, why aren't you supporting him? But let's say I see a child whose parents are not feeding him, his parents aren't giving him anything, and then I'm very, very, it's a very probing question, hey, where are you? Why aren't you feeding this kid? Why aren't you taking care of him? Why aren't you talking to him? Because even though technically, on a physical level, my assumption is nothing exists until... it doesn't bother me that much, but is it going to be constant accompaniment? No, okay. It doesn't... So even though in a dry technical term, you need a reason to give, but a parent is naturally a giver and a take care, and if I see a situation, a negative situation, there must be a reason. I'm angry at my kid. We've ruptured our relationship. What's wrong with this, that, whatever it is. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made this world to be a positive place. It says, Lo Sohu Vra L'Sheves Yitzara. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not create the world to be empty. He created the world to be. So yes, technically, until HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, there was nothing. But the minute HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Bracious, and he made a bria, we have a pasuk that says Lo Sohu Bra L'Sheves Yitzara. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world to exist. So a constant hashba of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the norm in the world. That's what the world is. If I find a pocket, thank you so much, Jessica. Thank you very, very much. If I find a pocket of lack in the world, I don't see it as missing, I see it as disrupted. It's not, well, of course a person doesn't have a mouth, of course a person doesn't see, unless HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants him. No, if a person can't speak, HaKadosh Baruch Hu muted him, because mitzad the rotzam of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is stopping what he wants to give. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to mashpia in the world, he wants the world to exist, to thrive, and to have. Light is a natural situation. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants the world to be lighted and enlightened, enlightened from him. Anything that's missing has a purpose as much as the original light has a purpose. If I can say over, I saw a letter a footnote wrote once, in his early years, it's printed, beautiful letter, and he writes, I have two friends. One of them complained, when I knock upstairs, nobody's home. He said, I got to know him, he was not a very deep person. My other friend said, whenever I knock upstairs, they decide not to answer my knock. And that person I got to know, and he's a much deeper person. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world to be positive. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu, once HaKadosh Baruch Hu lit up the world, anytime there's darkness, it's because the decision was made for a reason to close the light. The default setting of this world is an open light, and a decision was made closed. The Ran then explains, I'm not going to be mired in that so much, why over here it was extremely important to take away his ability to speak, but I think it's just a generally very positive a perspective on life. It's very different when you ask yourself, why didn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu remember to give me X, Y, Z? Or why is HaKadosh Baruch Hu withholding X, Y, Z from me? There's no, it says in the Pasuk, Nari Sigam Zakhan Tel Yisit Tzadik Ne'ezav V'Zaram Vak Shlachem. I never saw a forsaken Tzadik. So it's a difference between parents that don't care about a child or parents that made a decision to withhold something for whatever reason. It's even though both of them, the child doesn't have X, Y, or Z, but there's a world of difference between a parent that has abandoned a child, it's a terrible situation. A parent sometimes in the world of chinuch, it's appropriate to withhold something from a child. He needs to earn it, needs to appreciate it, he needs to understand its consequences, many reasons. But that means it's an actively engaged parent. So anytime we see in the world something missing, in our lives something missing, lacking, we don't achieve it because I'm not important enough HaKadosh Baruch Hu to give it. I'm important enough HaKadosh Baruch Hu to withhold it from me. And I need to ask myself why. Maybe sometimes it's because my job is to go through life with these challenges and to prove it can be done with these challenges. Sometimes it's there as a call for tshuva. Sometimes there as a call for tefillah. Whatever it is, it's a very different perspective on what's missing, as opposed, it's not missing, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu withholding it. Okay, this is a point I wanted to say over the Ran, and the Ran explains also why it's crucial that he can't speak, a very beautiful point, but I don't want to go into it, I want to leave it at this point. And now, I guess, you have the questions over Greenwald, or?
I don't have any particular
questions. So maybe throw it open, and whatever the older ones, we could discuss, I enjoy discussing it. I learn a lot from people's questions. Anybody would like to, yes. You want to call on the voice?
What course of action will you suggest to a parent that finds out their kid is watching porn?
Okay, so I'm glad you're looking from a parent's point of view, unless you're challenging how like a parent's reaction. But it's interesting that you're looking from that point side of the table. So let's go slowly. The worst thing is to react with your natural reaction. In other words, worse, a parent has values, the child's pornography is bad, and a child watching it is a bad thing. So you want to give over how you feel about it, not in a personal confrontation. And let's understand something. There's the value how it sits in my heart, and a very strong sense of how bad pornography is. It's inappropriate, it's a passionate value that really is right. When I'm trying to get someone else to do right, then I need to ask myself, how will I impact that person to get him to the point I want to? Not how do I feel about the issue? And that's a crucial difference. Let me give you an example. If someone were to come to me and come down really hard on some fault of mine, my reaction is not going to be, this man is absolutely right, and how could I have done such a terrible thing, and I must do tshuva. I'll tell you what my actions are. He's much worse than I am. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He listens to Lashon Hara, and he doesn't begin to understand me, and he does things that are much worse. Those are my first three things, and I think of a lot more offensive things. You think of pornography as being terrible. When you tell a child, you're a lowlife, that a person cannot take tochacha that destroys himself. You're much, much better off to take a very different tack. And you sit down and say, listen, I know what the Yetzer is, I understand it. I know how gratifying it seems to be, and it's natural, and everybody has seen something you shouldn't have in someone's life. Let me explain to you why it's such a bad course, and let me explain how we can go about stopping ourselves. That's a world of difference. You can tell him, you know, I know that you'd rather not be stuck on the stuff, and I know how hard it is. Yeah. So let's understand a calm sense. You need to reaffirm that you think extremely well of the child. You need to understand that as terrible as pornography is, everybody's got a hand or a foot. Everybody's seen it somewhere, unless you grew up in a very close, sheltered environment, and I'm skeptical even about that. That he just happened to be caught. That the road back, it doesn't lie by fasting 40 days in a row and sitting on a hot stove. It's taking reasonable measures, understanding yourself, understanding why this is what you don't want to do, and understanding a way how to get back and how to stay away from it. It takes caring a lot, extraordinary self-control, and wisdom about another person. And this is true across the board. Just having pornography is a person admitting
you
pornography
see,
is.
You can see a parent really breaking and thinking like, "Oh, now I make sure they can't do it. I gotta lock everything up."
And the worst way to do is that way.
Yeah.
Because let me explain you something. Pornography has many aspects in it, and one of them is it's a lovely place to be when life around you is hard, when your parents are nagging, when your rebbeim are screaming and yelling, when your friends don't like you. Life is terrible. You sit down, take out the phone, and it's pleasure. The you are driving the person. People need to live with a good sense of self and a world of pleasure. And you've done the best by the only place he has now is here. I'm sure this is very felt, but whatever it is, this is the only place where you'll find it. And it's just pure pleasure. I want to tell you something. I spent 3 weeks ago, I was in a rehab place from kids. And they spoke, each one spoke about his experiences. They all said, somewhere along the line, it started with feeling empty and nothing for them. And the first time they drank or took an opiate, one of them, or did heroin, they said, wow, this is Olam Haba. So you want to make sure that that's not what you're driving a person to.
And what if the kid doesn't share your, and I guess they won't say it outright, but you could sense, they don't share your value that this is such a terrible thing.
Correct.
They could just say, well, it's really amazing.
Correct.
I understand what you're saying.
So what you need is, you need to tap into something that the child will realize. There are different things you can tap into. Don't look at it religious. Tell a person, this draws you in and draws you in and draws you in, and you don't get out. The famous, I once heard a very corny joke from a therapist. He's a great therapist, but jokes are kind of corny. He spoke at the Agoda convention, and he said, you know, people get addicted to everything. Is that? He even had somebody who was addicted to brake fluid, you know, from a car. Everybody looked at him and says, yeah, he told me I can stop anytime I want. So yes, it counts definitely as the corny joke of 2017, but certainly the point is a cute point. The point is real. Anything, you need to find, ask a bach who's not doing much in yeshiva, and the guy says, oh, it's okay. Ask him, tell me the truth. Imagine you're a parent and your son is doing yeshiva exactly what you're doing. Tell him, imagine you're married to somebody, man or woman, whoever, if you're a man or a woman, and the other person is looking and ogling pictures of somebody else undressed. How would you feel if that's where the person is? Feel kind of really disgusted? You're not going to stop. If you learn to control yourself and to make use of your drives, then you're going to have an extraordinary loyal and positive marriage and relationships. If every time you look at a woman, immediately the trigger is sexual, that means a woman is never a person in your eyes. It's an object. Is that how you value humans? You need to tap into, any religious thing needs to tap into what the person feels. You need to know the child, and you need to say, what is that you want? And you need to know what to know, and explain to them how pornography or any addiction absorbs you, and you're able to produce nothing. One of the reasons why pornography is so bad, just anything which is a very powerful pleasure, gives you nothing in return and absorbs you, is an escape. And when someone says, yeah, I do it only occasionally, it's like the guy who snorts coke occasionally, it's the guy who drinks heavily occasionally, it's the brake fluid, you know? So that's the type of discussion you need to have. You need to tap into something that is meaningful to the child. You need to express to them subtly and everything about who, how much you value them as a person. And then you need to explain why this is this really going to undo it, and a sensible way how to move on. Yes, Max.
How, just maybe as a precursor to the question, how do you raise a child in America with purity? Whether, and it doesn't just have to be pornography, it could also be drugs, needles, cursing, all these different things that secular culture almost immediately exposes you to. How do you have good cleanup with a child in that environment?
Don't you want to say
yeshiva, that? Go to Washington. a shoo-in. That was what's the slam dunk? he went to the other school. That's the
it's like everywhere in the world, not just Hussar, it's even here.
It's true. So let's talk about it.
Yeah.
I would say it's comparable to, let's take health as an issue. Ramesh Shapiro's once told somebody. Somebody asked him, how do you know something like between two extremes? And Ramesh said, there is no way to get around using seichel. In other words, most things in life will not have a automatic one-sided answer as much as it'll have a need to balance. If you raise a child totally insulated, you raise a child in an environment in Yerushalayim somewhere, in Me'er Sharim, Yerushalayim is hard to do, Yerushalayim is not an insulated city, but let's say in Tifrach, which is a small town, it's a yeshiva town, and that's all you have there, in Lakewood, in the heart of Lakewood, you raise a child without any exposure whatsoever. There are advantages to that. The disadvantage is, it's like a child who's never exposed to disease. You raise them in a hospital with double doors. God forbid the day he walks out of the hospital, the day there's a tiny hole in the hospital, he will have an onslaught of bacteria that are going to destroy him. So I don't believe Hasidim, like Satmar Hasidim, thought that by total isolation, don't teach the language, don't let them be anywhere near women, don't do that, and they will be wonderful and pure. It doesn't work because inevitably we get exposed, and if a person is very insulated, that's counterproductive. On the other hand, I'll say, okay, so I will take my kids and raise them in the streets of a slum, so he'll be exposed to every single virus and bacteria there is, and that will make him strong and hardy. Yeah, if he survives till the age of 18, you know, the 1% chance, then okay, he'll be hard. So it's always a balance between the two. You want a child to be the earlier, the more insulated, and then you want to teach them about the world with you explaining. In other words, if you don't teach a kid anything about their drives, their physical drives, so maybe nothing will happen. Maybe the day he's aroused, he's not going to know what's going on with himself, and he has no kalim to deal with it. On the other hand, if you let him be exposed to everything, he will die of overdose. What you want to do is be able to sit down and explain to him, listen, this HaKadosh Baruch Hu made us, there's so much wonderful about the body, in the right time, in the right place, these are the nisyonos, this is how you deal with nisyonos. It's true across the board. One of the big differences, I would say, with the yeshiva world, and its full gamut is, my question, and this is a lot of times with parents, if your own home and life are steeped in American culture, it's a tough time. If the celebs are important people. If the games and everything that's happening in the popular culture is part of your world, it's what you live on, it's what you experience, it's what you hold up, you know, as chashuv, it's very hard to tell a child to leave normally. If your home environment and school environment is such that that's not the world, but you occasionally walk into that world and you understand that world, I think that's much healthier. I have a cousin of mine who lives in somewhere in New Jersey, and he belongs to a more modern Orthodox community. This person himself is a very serious person, and somebody made a bar mitzvah in that community, and they brought in 5 basketball players from New York. I'm talking about, I'm either Knicks or I don't know if the Nets, what kind of team they are, I forgot, but the Knicks, I'll assume it's the Knicks, and he paid them $10,000 a shot to come and to beautify the Simcha. And my cousin was very upset, and he said, you know, with $50,000 they could hire another Rebbe, they could raise this. I said, the school that you're talking about has enough money, they could do whatever they want. That's not the issue. I said, let me explain what the issue is. Would he have given Rav Soloveitchik $10,000 to come to the Bar Mitzvah and beautify it? He probably would have paid for his care, that's about it. So it's very clear to the kid about what's valuable in life. $10,000 a basket is what a basketball player is worth. A rabbi is worth the cab fare. So that's the problem. The big people, the important people we're supposed to ooh and ah about are people that... I was once standing by a terminal LaGuardia. I don't follow sports much. As a young boy, I did follow it. And I was kind of into it a bit, but it wasn't something that really spoke to me. And I was waiting outside, I think for cabs, that type of waiting. There was a woman standing next to me, and a big, tall, good-looking guy walks by, and her eyes pops out and says, "My gosh, I can't believe it!" And she pulls out a paper and asks him for an autograph. I think he must have been a famous player or something. He was coming like right next to the terminal. There was a signature jail, which is like private plane or something. And he gives the autograph. And then he turns to me, like, waiting, he said, "Say autograph?" I said, "No." And I think it was the first time I said, "No thanks." You know, I don't see the chashivas of the person, because he plays ball well. And I don't think that is a chashivas did. It's not the world. I think if kids grow up, it's not we're singers and actors and models are considered to be on the doubtful side of society, not on the chashivas side of society. They're not celebs. They're not famous. They're not important. Then it's different. Then at least the values are. So having the right culture at home, the right culture in the yeshiva, and using seichel, understanding some kids need, the Gemara talks about, you know, sometimes a parent may want to lend his child money with ribis, and he should pay interest in it, so the child learns a lesson, how difficult it is to repay a loan with ribis. Halachically, you can't do it, but it's the Gemara has a havmin on that. The Gemara has a havmin on all sorts of things that you may want to do so that the kid gets a sense of the forbidden so that he knows that it's not something to go into. Yes?
How insulated is insulated in today's world, and what's an example of that? I mean, I know you gave a few examples, but how far does the...
So
really insulated,
it's getting harder and harder because in my days when I went to school, you had to take a subway 4 stops to get to see the really good stuff. And we were 4 stops in Times Square, so anybody who wanted to go look at the stuff needed to take a subway. You needed to go to a newsstand where nobody was around, look around, make sure nobody was around, and buy something that you shouldn't. Today, it's in your pocket. You know, alavavcha, valibecha, you know, it's like, kshatim loisa yedecha, vaitat vais behenecha. It's unfortunately, so you have to make a decision what could and what can't. And Chassidim are struggling with it because they can't. Satmar is no longer insulated. You can't. The business guy has a phone. This person has a phone. Square fights desperately. They have a small community, relatively. They have a small area. And it's too porous. The world is porous, and you need to keep asking yourself what's possible and what's not possible. More important...
If it was possible, would that even be a goal?
No, more important... Let's explain something. More important... There was somebody I knew that is... he runs a professional typing service, and he said it is much more efficient that somebody types at a rapid clip where you have X percentage of mistakes and then you go over to correct the mistakes, then you type slower and make sure there are no mistakes. It's much more effective. In my mind, it's much more effective that you take into account there's going to be exposures if the general atmosphere is positive and healthy. And when you see that a kid is really getting into something, you're able to cope with it, it's much, much more effective than dreaming that you can insulate the kid from everything. A therapist from Queens told me once, she's an amazing woman. She deals with extraordinary hard cases. A very sensible person. I spent some time speaking with her. I was amazed. But she was telling me that there was two parents, and one says that her daughters are so pure and holy, they don't talk about anything, they don't know anything, whatever. And it's a whole long story, but her daughter was the one that explained to everybody who's expecting and when they're expecting and what happens when expecting, and the whole, she was the most knowledgeable, she was the encyclopedia about it. That was the end of the story. It was an incredible story, a true story that came to her death. You can't make things, it's just like, I know somebody who had a chain of supermarkets. He told me, same story, same idea. He said he invests in security, but he prices things expecting there will be X percentage of loss through theft, rather than invest 10 times as much in having a Fort Knox. You can't run a supermarket like a Fort Knox. So you're going to take into account X amount of problems. So you balance. You like you said, it's not possible and it's not even desirable. At the end of the day, and the child has to interact. Everybody's not going to sit and learn it in a pure colo in the heart of Lakewood. You're going to go out, you're going to interact, you're going to see things. You need to be able to deal with it.
So no matter where you live, you have to...
Sorry, what?
So no matter where you live, you have to...
Correct. It's just that each place has a different age, different issues. That's what I'm saying. There's a big sweeping principle of insulation versus exposure, and you can't take any extreme and just go with it. You need to be able to balance and understand and take into account there will be patches to be made rather than finding something perfect. Yes, sir?
With that in mind, we're hearing a lot in the last 3 weeks about the precious of Rav Steinman.
Yes.
Is that something, how does the Rosh Yeshiva understand it? And is that something we should be avoiding Yeshiva? Our boys, anyways, should be focused on separating from oil and mazah.
So Rav Steinman was extremely fascinating. I spoke about it recently, actually, about this point, about the precious. Yes, he himself was almost disconnected from this world. All the stories are probably true. I don't know this. I know a lot that's true, and probably all the stories I heard are true. But two things. Most people that you meet that are parish from Olam Hazeh tend to be very miserable, angry, upset, annoying people. It's like somebody once said, "Oyev Hashem is a tzaddikim," because only Hashem could love tzaddikim. Everyone else has a hard time. Rav Steinman was one of the most pleasant, easy people to interact with and communicate with. There was an ease and a sweet sense of humor to him, and just pleasantness. Two, he most of the time recommended for other people not precious. Somebody wrote in the newspaper that Rav Steinman sent him to collecting, worked very hard to get collecting business. When he came back, he said, "Do me a favor. Here's money. Take your wife. Take a weekend and go for a vacation." Rav Steinman, the word vacation didn't exist in his lexicon, but he understood. They asked him a chinuch question. It's your child is home, Be'ezmanim, from yeshiva, and he's sleeping, and Zasman Krishna's coming. What should you do about it? He thought, he said, wake him up, but don't nudge him. Wake him up and tell him Zasman Krishna. If he falls back asleep, he falls back asleep. Don't push more than that. He had a very different approach to others. And let me explain to you two areas. First of all, his own precious was it was because he got into Ruchnias so much. The mashal I used was you know, sometimes when a person is really a driven businessman, he's doing great deals, he doesn't eat lunch and doesn't eat supper, we don't call that precious. He's so much into his business that he doesn't have time to eat, but it's a happy, positive kind of thing. When it comes out of a love of learning, that learning is I don't care to eat. I'm not thinking about the pizza, and Shiva food usually helps that you're not so involved with that, and the learning actually becomes a little more interesting than the food. So the positive getting into learning is important. One thing I do think preachers could work, and let me think. To stop eating, to think about what you're eating, what you're not eating. That I'm not a big chassid of. So yeah, if somebody's got a problem, if he's really got some overeating disorder, he should see a therapist. Not, you know, it's not doing much good. That's not what we're holding. But there is something that we should be holding. That food becomes a culture. I'm a curious person. I like reading a lot. It's always been something I like doing. And especially one of the things I was curious as a child was about different countries and so on. Wherever I go someplace, I try to pick up all the literature, the stuff you can still read, you know, that's about the place. So there'll be a place, and inevitably, there may be one line about the place, and then you got to try this restaurant, you got to try that restaurant, the other place, this food, that food, and they make a rare steak, and they broil it, and they bring wine. Klum, the culture's all eating. A great project is not to discuss food. The culture of a restaurant, the culture of food, you need to eat, fine. Where's a good place to eat that's relatively, that's, you know, affordable? This place. But how they make the steak, and when they serve the wine, and what the bulka tastes like, that's a world that's empty. And a person who's osek in real things, a person who's osek in Torah, a person who's learning Mesechtes Beitzah should not be discussing omelets in the restaurant. Beitzah is this. You know, there should be, so what bothers me, I have a friend of mine, he's a huge Talmud Chacham, a big Baal Kishrin, and he's a Ish Chacham, he's a Chacham. His wife's family are wonderful people, but they're kind of part of the bigger American culture. And they were sitting at the table, and they were discussing whatever it was, and one said, oh, this food is kind of, it arouses your curiosity, and it piques your interest, and this food actually has something that, you know, whatever. And he said, Rabbi Isai, you want to talk about food, say you like the taste, you don't like the taste, don't attribute intellectual value to, you know, when you speak about a story, a book, you say, oh, this book arouses your curiosity, this book has meaning, it has depth. Food is food. Keep it to your stomach, not to your mind. That was his lesson to that. So that is a precious, that is positive. It's positive because it's the world you're going to live in. It adds nothing. For a bacher to start patching with which food to eat, which not food, it's too close to becoming an unhealthy obsession. And you know, not at this stage, not at this point. You know, if a person has weight problems, then staying away from really good, you know, really heavy stuff is a good idea for other reasons. But I think this would be the way to. Yes?
I've mentioned beforehand about speaking English. I wanted to ask this earlier when you get better. You're saying about speaking to, like.
What's your name? Where are you from?
Daniel. I don't know, from Queens.
Yeah.
Next language. So basically, like, let's say if you tell your child and you explain to him, basically, you brought him up with your morals, and he just, let's say if, like, you would have said, like, if you watch his, like, bad stuff, right? He's going after a lot of his titles. But let's say like you have someone that you want to explain to, let's say smoking weed.
Let's say what?
Smoking weed.
Yeah.
So I'm saying, in the general, the world, like, morally we know it's not something you're supposed to do. And you try to explain it to them, but they just say there's nothing bad with it. I'm saying I'll do it with my kids. It's better. It's the same thing as drinking. There's like drinking is fine. Weed is fine. There's no health. Doesn't take
away health problems. So let's explain chinuch a little bit in a bigger picture. When I was growing up, I think we lived in Lower East Side, which today it's sort of a glorified, it was slums. That's, I guess, the best way to describe it. They were old houses overpopulated by poor people, and my parents were immigrants and refugees, and, you know, that was it. across the street from where we grew up. So I lived in one place for 2 years, and they built these huge co-ops. So I don't know if those are familiar. This big housing down across, big modern buildings, and affordable housing of nice, decent apartments. And that's where we moved in, and that's where I lived most of my life. But as a kid, I grew up watching them build these huge buildings. And, you know, so first thing is they dug this huge hole in the ground. Then they put these metal pieces in, they poured the cement on it, and it just looked like a lot of slabs and columns. And then they covered the whole thing up with earth again, and it looked like way when it started. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out what in the world they're doing. I don't know if somebody explained to me then, or I figured out later, is if you build a building, it has to be attached to something. And if the ground is sand, you'll have a beautiful building, but you don't need an elevator because the building is going to start going down, and you know, it doesn't have what to stand on. You first need to build a platform, and on the platform you build. Every person has built-in axioms that are in his, they're the bedrock. So, LaMarshall, if you grow up, almost everybody grows up in a home where stealing is terrible. So when he does something, he finds a way to avoid paying the meter or something. So your battle is to explain why this is stealing, or why everybody does it and he shouldn't do it. But stealing is bad. Let's say your child is stealing, and you grows up with the idea that stealing from everybody is okay except from a fellow gypsy. So now you tell him, you're doing that? That's stealing. Guy says, exactly. Baruch Hashem, Baruch Shekibanti. Like, what are you talking? One of the difficulties is you need to tap into somebody's bedrock of values. And if you build, so the first, the most essential value that you can inculcate in a child, that Hashem made me, means I was put in this world for a purpose. And a wasted life, even if it tasted good, is the most terrible thing. It's hard to explain it in the light of something else. It has to come as something where I need. If a child sees that that his parents don't kill time, that the word "I'm just going to kill a few hours," you can say "I'm going to take it easy for a few hours because I need this. I need to get calm, stress off. I need to take a vacation. I need to take a break because I'm overstressed." That is a good part. That's part of the value of productivity. You're using a machine 24/7 is not productive. But building those core values where a child has tachlis productivity, in a world where productivity is good, what am I accomplishing? What did I do? If you have a tsar on a wasted day, then the child picks up the core values. You can then you have what to build on. And that's really where the most chinuch lies in. And it has a lot to do with our own behavior, our own values. A child absorbs his parents' values, even in the tkufis that rebels against it. But at the end of the day, they seep in at a very, very core level in his personality. And that's what you're trying to tap into. Yes?
With that in mind, America is allowing so many things today, even legalizing.
Yes.
Be it drugs and marriages. How are we supposed to react to that?
I think one of the core components of chinuch is that we have values that are clear and they come from someplace strong and holy. America doesn't have values. They have feelings, they're nice people, a lot of nice things, but what's a marriage? Who's a marriage? How can someone just decide what a marriage is? A marriage is something. It's not a legal contract between two people to supply goods. It's something deeper than that. The secular world has no shaykhahs to it. And I think that attitude, we're not Americans, we're Yidden. We live in America, we need to participate and do our share as a citizen. Those are Jewish values, but the most important thing is that to reach the type of understanding who we are, we're Jews, and a strong sense of identity as a Torah Jew is crucial, and that comes in not by preaching at the child, but by living it. You know, I'm a Yid. I live in America. America is a wonderful place. They've given us a lot. It's of all the countries we've ever lived in, it's probably been the best to us. The people, the Americans, are decent people. They're good people. Unfortunately, they had values through Christianity and they've discarded them, and therefore they're blind. They're not bad, they're just blind. It's like asking, why is a blind person bumping into me? Because he's blind, not because he's malicious. And they have no vows, so of course anything can marry anything. If marriage is a certificate, nothing more, nothing less than that, what's the problem? Yes, Ben.
How does live and let live play into Judaism? Like, people seem to take a lot of righteous offense at gay people being allowed to marry, even though they don't understand that these two people love each other, and let them do what they want as long as I can do what I want. Like, they don't understand because they themselves aren't.
So live and let live is a statement of something being valueless. In other words, that's what you say. Let me just nuance it a bit. There are things, there are flavors that everybody hates. So some people, there are always these soda flavors that only one odd guy likes. So you can say, ugh, I don't like it, that's fine. But you like it, that's also fine. And there's no more than that. So any system that does not have any values coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so yeah, the most effective thing is, I'll do things I want to do, you do things, as long as nobody's hurting anybody else, nobody seems to be hurting anybody else, that's fine. We understand that we're neshama chelek ha'kai mimal, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the wisdom that understands right and wrong, we don't, and therefore, there's right and wrong whether or not you subscribe to it. It's right and wrong by definition. HaKadosh Baruch Hu defined it as wrong. So one question is how to deal with people that do other things. The other question is it emphatically say that it's bad. Let's imagine I have a person in my community who inherited a ton of money from his family, and he's well supplied with drugs for the rest of his life. He sits home, he dopes himself 2-3 times a day, depending on how strong he is. That's what he does. So I tell him, I come to him, I say, oh, that's terrible. The person says, none of your business. Possibly, okay. But I certainly should make a statement in my home that this is a tragedy. A human being who has an neshama could accomplish, could produce, was sent this world, and he's died the minute he was born. He's died with it, and it's terrible. I need to make that point because I believe that way. Should I try to explain out of it? I believe, but certainly with Dr. Norm, if I can influence the person and convince him of those values, I would be saving his life, because basically he's dead. And I do feel that this is emes l'amito. Should I take action and do something? That's a whole different question of, in a secular society, what are my responsibilities? In a Torah society, yes. Just like if someone should commit suicide, the person will tell me, live and let die. You know, I would say no. Saving a life, even if you right now are in a terrible mood, I need to save it. I think many people subscribe to that. You don't say, well, you do what you want to do, I'll do what I want to do. To me, a person who's on drug dress life is that. And I believe the same God that gave me life and neshama said that this is, when we say it's punishable by death, what it means is it's equivalent to that in its chumrah. Do I understand it? No. But I firmly believe that this is emes because this is the way it has to be. And the God who created everything gave ascribed values of good and bad. So live and let live is a value possible only if there's no objective standard. So when you like flavors, live and let live is a good thing. You like this. It's like, you know, sometimes you have couples where you have a weird dynamic where somebody eats something and the wife or vice versa say, this is horrible. I can't bear that you eat this stuff because it's really gross. The guy says, well, I like it. No, it's terrible. You can't possibly like it and you take it away. There are some, there's a problem there. Somebody's got some issues over there. But when you're talking about moral things, then yes, right and wrong exists and live and let live is not a value, not a Jewish value. Yes?
You have mentioned maintaining Jewish identity
yes.
in America and also how America has been.
How
I? I feel like part of the shaykhus that Jewish identity has toward the Yisrael and B'yat Mashiach entails a certain uncomfortability living in the diaspora and the fact that Mashiach is obviously not here yet. What level of comfortability can we have in the diaspora, America especially, considering it's such a welcome country, versus you know, our longing for Eretz Yisrael in an ideal fashion, not at least for his name.
So let me tell you something I once heard from Soloveitchik on Tisha B'Av. He expressed an extraordinarily poignant point. He said, I think it was in the Kinnis. I think I know where he's about. I'm not even sure. He said people say that we're in Eretz Yisrael and we're by the Kaisel, and it's like almost the Golus is over, something like that. That was basically. He says, you know, sometimes you have a father and a son where they broke apart and the son went off and not connected to father, and that's terrible. He used to speak with a sort of a Germanish type of it. He says, sometimes you have that relationship, but circumstances are chasam, and it forces the son to sit next to his father. But there's that same gulf between them as when he was living in Africa a few thousand miles away. This is the most terrible tension. He says, to be so close and yet to be severed. And he basically said, we're standing by the Kaisel, but Hashem wants to have nothing to do with us. Understanding Golus in its depth, a person's inner ruchnius, the search, is to be connected to Kadosh Baruch Hu. And Golus means there's been a tremendous service relationship. Kadosh Baruch Hu will begrudgingly toss us a few crumbs, and that's it. That's what we long for. Eretz Yisrael is the only place where it will ever express itself. It'll never. America will never become the home for the Jews and a Kadosh Baruch Hu united. But Eretz Yisrael also doesn't have it, because a Kadosh Baruch Hu, it's like imagine a couple split, and each one went to live somewhere else, and then one day they move back to the old apartment, the old house, but the other side is not moved in yet, so you're not reconciliated. You need to understand that Ruchnius is a pneumistic akasha. Eretz Yisrael is an absolute need for it. There is Ruchnistic value to living in Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara says so, Raman brings it. But the Geula means HaKadosh Baruch Hu turning back and saying, I want to get back together again. That's what it is. So sometimes it's easier in America than Eretz Yisrael. And it, you know, again, Eretz Yisrael certainly has a lot more ruchnis than America. You feel the kedusha. You see people grow in yeshiva so much more. People live a life of kedusha. And, you know, that's definitely. But understand that when you're talking about goals and goal, you're talking about something much, much deeper. I have time maybe for one more question, and then okay. So, who, somebody hasn't asked yet. Let somebody.
Yes.
Any repeat offenders? Okay. Yeah.
The question is how to deal with, personally and I guess in the home too, cynicism in general. And what I mean by that is when, let's say personally, you look at a group of people and you just have an icky feeling, let's say it's Israelis. Well, I don't like Israelis. Now, I can sit down logically and say, I suppose they have their own culture, but or even we're talking about the gay thing, how you talk in the home about how this is equal to death, but how do you stay away from being cynical about a group of people? Or is that poison? And if it is, how do you deal with that?
It is, because what happened a long, long time ago was Adam Rishon ate from a tree that was called not the bear tree, but Eitz Hadas Tov V'Ra. The world today is a mixture of good and bad. And anything that comes your way, you need to understand where's it coming, what's the good over here, what's coming good, and where's what needs to get rid of, and what's my role, how much need I be involved. If you can look at the best person, understand where's a weakness, what happens is when you're very naive and you think things are perfect, when you come on some fault, everybody has a fault, everybody has something, you're shattered because your belief was wrong. And when you meet somebody who's kind of a fairly objectionable person, somebody that you don't like, understand what his personality is. Why has it been this way? And you know, most of the time, people that are negative, it's because they're unhappy with themselves. Most people who are happy with themselves can be kind to people outside. Let me tell you, I'll finish up with a very nice story that I heard 2-3 days ago from Dazan. Shapiro Zvonimbruch had a father-in-law. People don't know him. His name was Reb Aaron Bielostutsky, or Reb Aaron Brisker, it's called. I remember him when he's an older person. He was a huge Talmud Chacham, very serious person. I remember him as a very serious person, no nonsense type of personality. I saw him a few times and occasions, and his grandchildren told me that, you know, he's the grandfather you have to be in good behavior with. His daughter, Moshe Shapiro Zalmana, told this person, I had heard the beginning of the story, and it never ended. They were living in Yerushalayim in the years when the anti-religious feelings were very sharp and bitter. Don't anyone tell you it's because we have things our way to be resented. They were lahash v'naharo. They were aduk fastuk, lech mekan chared. You know, and they were a big majority, and it was intense and it was brutal. She was walking with her father. She was 6 years old. They were walking down Gula, and somebody assaulted him verbally, not physically. And she held onto her father's foot like this, trembling. And this person said everything filthy and mean about Haredi people. And when he finished, he just got out of breath. Her father said, "And as for me, I love you because you're a fellow Jew." So this person was shocked, and then he ran. The next morning, she opened up the door. There was a box of milk standing there. Now, milk was expensive. They couldn't usually afford milk. And every day there was a box of milk there. So she and her brother woke up very, very early, and they saw the same person. It was him bringing. And it went on for a few years. She said, "That's how we had milk." And she asked the father, "Did you really mean it when you said it? How could you?" He said, "I saw in front of me somebody, a very hurt person. For a person to be so negative and so angry, it must be that something is hurting really deeply, and I felt very, very, very much for him." It's a big person, you know, and it's something to learn from. And so I guess this is a place I have to get moving. So, but it's been wonderful speaking with you, and really wonderful group of people. And work, so keep growing, keep shining.
Thank you very much.
Nice. No,
I'm not going to go to the left.
Those that would like to meet representatives from the Shigrizola will be up.